Joe and Michelle, first of all, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us about your documentary, American Promise. I have to say, watching it was kind of poignant for me. I'm also in the midst of college decisions with my kids. I'm kind of wondering and worrying about their prospects, looking back over their childhoods, hoping I did the right things. And it's a tough time, don't you think?
Absolutely. But retrospectively, I think your audience needs to know that they will be okay and the parents will be okay. You know, there's so much intensity in terms of the other parents, the school. But looking back over it, you know, our son made a great decision. Most of these kids are really accepted to their one of their top two or three choices. 70% of these kids will get in. 70% of the colleges are really would admit these young men and young women. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of anxiety over things that have nothing to do with reality.
Well, I think in America right now, especially, I mean, we're still in the midst of or just coming out of a recession, and you know, there's so many different economic problems that our kids are going to wind up facing, and we conflate all of that into education. The question of what kind of education our kids are going to get, and you know, we ask very large questions.
Yes, and you know, I think for me, in terms of what these level of anxiety kind of meant is, understanding that, you know, as coming from a Black immigrant family from the Caribbean. First generation college educated. You know, my mother has a sixth grade education and my father barely finished high school. So for me, education was the ticket as I was growing in spite of, looking and suffering from various amounts of discrimination at multiple levels. So it was this level of anxiety and need and drive to inculcate that same kind of perspective to the next generation, because we know how fragile for us middle class status is, especially within the Black community and other communities of color as we look at the statistics today. So one of the things that I knew that could not be taken away from Idris is his education and skill level. That he would carry that with him for the rest of his life, and it would be something that could open the door for him. And the better that education, the more doors would be open.
You remind me of a clip from the film, which I think we have. It's from very early on in the documentary, just as you were making the decision to enroll Idris at Dalton, this very elite prep school in Manhattan. Let's hear this clip.
Idris is extremely bright. He's very curious and sensitive. Maybe those are terms that all parents use for their children. But he scored in the top 2 or 3% in terms of these educational testing. So we have a lot of expectations. Dalton will open doors for him for the rest of his life.
It's gonna hopefully allow him to compete at the top level with his peers.
What do you say, Bobby? I thought you said Britney Spears.
No, that's not what I said.
But who is Britney Spears?
Britney Spears is a singer.
How old was Idris then?
He was 5.
Oh, he's just so adorable in the film. And Michelle, you didn't actually, at the very first, you weren't necessarily that keen on him going to Dalton. You thought it was a school for rich white kids. What changed your mind?
Well, what changed my mind were a couple of things. One is, you know, visiting that school, that kindergarten class, the admissions director, and having conversations with her and seeing really how individualized the attention appeared to be to these young children. The level of academic exposure was just amazing to see. And then hearing them talk about their mission to really create a more multicultural environment within the student body, and that it was a mission that they were taking seriously. But the other side of that was, I was adamant to, you know, explore the public school system in New York and see how my son could get the best education in that environment. But what I saw there was not better than Dalton in terms of the numbers and the diversity in the higher performing schools, whether it's the intentional, you know, district delineations that exist and kind of coincide with the best districts of the predominantly white, you know, neighborhoods and the high performing, gifted and talented classrooms, even when they are within a largely of color public school building, my son would still be one of few. Mm-hmm. So when you're presented with that type of choice, the question is, you know, what's the best way? Mm-hmm. And do I sacrifice my child as I try to make change? Or do I try to give him the best opportunity possible where I see an intentional, you know, mission to engage in creating a different environment?
Were the Dalton students primarily white when Idris first enrolled?
They were primarily white. The admissions director had been specifically hired a few years prior to Idris coming in to specifically change the makeup of the classrooms and of the school. So we were promised an environment while at the initial stages of this change where he would be surrounded by more students of color. Did not quite, you know, pan out that way for his particular grade. The grades behind him were slightly more diverse, but we had hoped for more. But as the years went on, we saw that that was not what happened until he reached high school. When he reached high school, we definitely saw a big number shift that ultimately actually made his experience better.
You know, of course, as parents, we want to give our kids every opportunity to succeed. Other than the academic opportunities at Dalton, Joe, were there other skills you were hoping Idris would learn?
Sure. I mean, there's a we are discussing the decision, and it seems as if we're talking about race, but what we're really talking about is our son turning into a great human being. We're looking at critical thinking. We're looking at academic achievement. We're looking at his moral development and sense of empathy and sharing. And what we thought was that the diversity would help ensure that. We were led to believe that that school would look like the city of New York. And so the diversity that we were looking for was not just in terms of race, mm-hmm. but it was in terms of social class and geographical diversity, mm-hmm. With the goal of achieving those aforementioned goals. But it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And what we found out shortly after beginning kindergarten, there were three boys of color in the kindergarten class of 90. And so that was a concern, but we saw their commitment. We thought we would work it through. And then we came face to face with something that we call implicit bias.
Yeah. So let's talk about how the experience actually played out. Early on at Dalton, you got a note from the school about how Idris was, quote unquote, hard to manage. Actually, we've got that clip. Let's take a listen.
They told us that our son is a hard-to-manage guy. He's not a hard-to-manage guy. He's soft-spoken. He's eager. My concern is that they don't know him.
Right.
There's great difficulty with impulse control, both physically and verbally. He talks out of turn continually, has trouble respecting other
students' physical boundaries. A goal for him is to make an extra effort to focus on activities without distracting others. Okay.
They've decided that our son is a problem. He's not a problem at home. He's not a problem in the community. He's a problem at Dalton. And the question is, what is it about Idris that makes him disruptive?
Well, not so much what it's about him, what is it about the environment?
Yeah. I don't know.
So that was in grade one, two? I mean, do you think there was some kind of cultural disconnect or misperception happening way back then?
Absolutely. I mean, he came home in kindergarten, and what did he say to me? He says, you know, Dad, they keep asking me, am I rich or am I poor? I keep saying I'm in the middle, but they keep asking me. And so to some extent, he was dealing with perception the day he walked in the door, whether he was a poor kid from the inner city. And he was trying to let them know, I am the son of a physician and attorney, and that I have my own bedroom, and I can read. And we had to face that essentially every day of his life. And he would constantly ask and be asked over and over again who you are. And so for us, it became a concern, but we began to develop the tools through which he could say, I am Idris Brewster. I love learning. I am not angry. I am not fidgety. And I'm going to be somebody.
I think part of what, as I re-listen to these comments, is, you know, the phrasing of it and how it was engaged with is not self-reflecting on what is it that I as a teacher can do, you know, to make him feel more comfortable, to make him feel more, you know, entitled and feel part of the community.
You think the teachers were not sort of intervening when Idris was continually being asked to identify himself?
They were equally projecting their own assumptions onto their interactions with him, and probably without even realizing that they were doing it. This is part of what, you know, we talk about in our book and in some of the conversations we've had across the country, is this notion of implicit bias or unconscious, you know, assumptions, or some term unconscious racism, that we call all internalize and project upon groups that we do not know that well without even knowing. So they're filling in the blanks about who they think he is. He's receiving these messages and these actions and doesn't really know what to do with it.
At what age were you able to have that conversation with Idris and explain to him what was going on in a way that he could really understand and also use?
You know, let me back up just a minute.
Yeah.
Because the question really is what is implicit bias, and the assumptions that unconscious assumptions that you may have about an African American boy or an Asian boy or a white female are universal. That means those negative or positive assumptions are shared by the entire population. They're informed by history. They're informed by the media that we're exposed to on a daily basis. So, you know, there have been some pretty terrible prejudices and assumptions and biases directed at African-American boys based on our history. So it's not unlikely that you're going to be question as to your ability to read or to write or your criminality, because you're going to see it on television every day. So when you ask your question, when did we start talking about it? We always talk about it, but it's not explicit, the conversation. You know, we might say, we begin by giving him an appreciation for who he is. We give him the tools, but they're age appropriate.
Right. One example is even in terms of his name, Idris. You know, he came to us very early on about wanting to change his name because he heard other names in the classroom and that this made him feel different, you know. And so we sat down and talked to him on multiple times about, you know, the proud history behind his name, why we chose it, You know, Idris was the first human mortal to read in the Quran, that there's a whole North African tradition of using his name, and why we picked it, and how we came about identifying that. And it was more to make him proud and entitle and have the message that he needed to confront, you know, microaggressions in the school or elsewhere. Now, those things don't necessarily always sink in at the beginning. Sometimes our children don't want to hear it, and they're more interested in seeing in being approved by their peers. Mm-hmm. But that's where the hard work happens in terms of continuing the same mantra, but also finding like-minded or similarly situated students such as Idris of color going through the same kinds of experiences who can connect with him. Mm-hmm. And those are things that we set out to find as well.
So our goal really is to have everybody talking, teachers, parents, the kids themselves. And what we found through trial and error, that the more folks are able to have this discussion about differences, the more families were able to really discuss these biases, the better the kids would perform.
Yeah, Joel likes to talk about it in terms of difference and biases, but it's really about talking about race and talking about race in a way that's constructive in safe environments, whether it's for the youth, for the parents, and for the educators also to be more in tune with what are some of the assumptions that we're all carrying with us that inform how we interact and how we raise or lower the bar academically for our students. In a way that's very unconscious.
Now, one of the things that crops up in the film is that despite the presumably great teaching at Dalton, Idris and his friend Shan, who are also at the school, were maybe falling behind the other students. Let's hear this clip.
We got a letter from Dalton inviting Idris to participate in this tutoring program. And he was having some issues in fourth grade, but we didn't know they were going to recommend tutoring. So I asked, how was he selected? And she told me, well, we offer this to students who are on financial aid, so it's a way to make it more of a level playing field. But then we found out that in Idris's grade, he and Shayon are the only two kids in the entire grade taking this tutoring program. I don't want the tutoring to be at the expense of him being perceived a certain way that's totally inaccurate. I think that there's a perception that these are young black boys who need extra help because they're not used to this kind of exposure.
What the school says is that many of his classmates are receiving tutoring.
Some of the parents are spending up to $30,000 a year for tutoring. That's more than the tuition.
So throughout the film, it's clear that Idris and Shayon are really smart kids, and they work really hard at school. But it just seems like these questions of race and income keep getting muddled up with their education.
I mean, I think that particular clip that you decided to bring out is really, I think, really central in kind of understanding the multiple levels that we're talking about around how, to the extent to which the field is not level and how rules change and how do we end up becoming aware of the rules. And they have to do with race and class. Class in the sense that we were not aware as a family that there were so many other white students taking tutoring at home in the privacy of their homes and for enrichment, not for remedial. And the school was attempting to do the right thing, but didn't realize or was not aware of the racial consequences of that by picking out, you know, the two African-American boys in the class to do this tutoring in school. Mm-hmm. And so there are racial and economic implications to that. And the question is, you know, what type of promise are we engaging in, you know, when we when all of these factors become, we become aware of all of these factors.
What do you mean? What kind of promise?
Well, I mean, when we're talking diversity at a place like that, or just generally, I think it does a disservice to what we're really talking about. And what we really need to be thinking about is inclusion and equity. It's not just about bringing, you know, a variety of different bodies into the space, but it's about talking, what does that mean, and what is our vision for the community, whether it's the school community or beyond, when we're still having to play catch up when the diversity happens. So these are more deeper questions that the entire community has to kind of wrestle with and grapple with and figure out, and where you kind of have to put your money where your mouth is in terms of of the mission to create a more multicultural space.
Mm. So what we really believe also is that things needed to be made more explicit in terms of the environment we were going to. Here are two young men who tested at the highest levels of achievement prior to entering that institution and are perceived as struggling. Even during their most intense struggles, they were still testing at the highest level of education in this country, and began to lose confidence in themselves, lose confidence in their ability to learn, and lose confidence in their ability to have a future.
At some point, did you begin to worry about whether this whole experience was going to wind up sapping Idris's self-confidence rather than enhancing it?
Absolutely. And we began to intervene in a major way. Some of the interventions we discussed earlier, we began to try to bolster his esteem at home. We began to work on his organization. We began to expose him to people who looked like him, who were proud of their academic heritage and their love for reading, writing, art. And we began to expose him to other young men and women who look like him. Mm-hmm. And so we began to work on his social-emotional development, which we believe lagged in that environment.
You guys also, you worked with Idris to come up with a pretty serious study schedule. I mean, there are all these scenes. It looks pretty intense. I mean, there are these scenes of Idris studying late into the night, looking totally exhausted, and you guys are really on him about, you know, did you finish this homework? What do you mean you don't have your book? What grade did you get on that test? Were all the other Dalton families that intense about the academics, or do you feel like you pushed Idris harder?
Well, let me discuss that briefly. I don't think Idris, this is a film, and what you see is excerpts from his life.
Sure.
Strung together. But, you know, you have to look at, you know, aside from your geniuses and your people who or basically have impediments to learning, Idris was right in there in terms of the number of hours. You know what we were dealing with? We were dealing with television and digital media. One of the struggles that we have as African American parents is being demanding enough. And the reality is your average low income on an African American family watches about 55 to 70 hours worth of television a week. So what you saw in me developing a spreadsheet is my attempt to eliminate that use of television, actually limit some of the time that was not being spent adequately. He had free time, but for the average boy who watches 60 hours worth of television, they're borrowing from sleep to get through their day.
The bottom line for us, and I think for many, for many African American families and Latino families, when it comes to looking at the message that's out there or what's being reinforced, whether in the public school or private school or charter school or any of these schools, the bar is too low. The bar is not raised for our boys when it comes to looking at the potential and what they're capable of academically. And we have to kind of fight that projection that happens. And a part of it is raising the bar and creating a structure where, you know, hard work is understood and what it means and what kind of results you can get from that. And that's part of our role as parents. The larger messages are opposite from what we do. So it's important for us to provide that counter narrative, I think.
We're proponents of unstructured time and free play. But if we look at the numbers in terms of who's achieving, who's not achieving, there's almost a linear relationship between, you know, study hours. Do we allow our son to make a decision as to whether he's going to brush his teeth or take a bath once a week? No. And so what you see in the film is we see us as families saying, no, this is our commitment to education. And it's a daily commitment. We're going to enforce that. And, you know, when they get older, they really make their own decision. Right now, my son is a sophomore at Occidental College. And he has the same study schedule as he had when he was 14 or 13. We're not enforcing that. But it's like brushing your teeth. He brushes his teeth daily because we as parents said that this was important to us. You know, our son had to read a half an hour a day. And we think that's important. If we were able to convince young men around the country to do that, what we think is that you'll see what we call the gap begin to dissipate very rapidly. So we as parents were involved, and we understand everyone doesn't have the same level of involvement, but it worked for Idris.
I'm curious, Idris is in college now. What does he say about his Dalton experience? Looking back, does he think it was a good experience?
I wish you were here to answer that, but he, in his conversations with me, Idris really highlights his high school experience as the best part of his time at Dalton, and there are a number of reasons for that he points to and that we actually observed, but unfortunately, did not have access to in terms of the filming as much as we would have liked. One of the biggest things to really create a shift for him was the fact that from the get-go he had an African American male advisor, who was also his English teacher on more than one occasion throughout his 4 years. And the reason why that was so crucial was not just his personality type, but the fact that he had a role model who was an adult, who was not part of his family, who both kind of supported him socially and emotionally, understanding maybe some of the tensions and obstacles that he faced as an African-American boy in that environment. But also, he was definitely someone who raised the bar for Idris. So we were all on the same page in terms of understanding, we know what your potential is, and we're here to support you and make sure, or at least encourage you to understand that through the work, you are able to fulfill that potential and that you can do better and that you can do well. And to have that kind of presence constantly there that's not coming necessarily from home is really key to them having a sense of the type of scholar they can be or the type of person that they can be, the potential that they have. The other element was also the fact that I mentioned this earlier, was that Dalton brought in many more students of color from all around New York City into the high school. So he, therefore, at that point, had a larger critical mass of students that were similarly situated as him in terms of the commute, in terms of socioeconomics, in terms of, you know, parental background that allowed him to validate his experience mm-hmm. in the school. And that was really key. Another really important aspect that you see a glimpse of in the high school is the school offered many different courses around African-American literature, history, and perspectives that he definitely gravitated towards that allowed him to learn more about his own history and validate his experience as being on par within that environment.
Mm-hmm. You sent Idris to Dalton to raise the bar for him, as you said, and to help him get to a place where he could compete almost as though there's a level playing field. Does he now, do you feel like that level playing field exists for Idris now?
No. The level playing field, how can I say it? It does not exist because our society hasn't changed to that extent. But what he does have is a critical awareness of the structure that exists around him and how he can navigate the different environments, hopefully to his advantage, how he can be a critical thinker in understanding dynamics that happen to him right now, you know, at the college level, possibly, and where he can rely on connecting with other students to help create change either within the college that he's at or in his larger community. So part of our job, I think, is really to create that greater awareness of the complicated world they live in and his ability to navigate the different waters with a sense of self that's strong. You want to jump in, Joe?
Yeah, but I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay.
because what we are, we're leveling the playing field. It's not level. What we're saying is that for the rest of his life, unless American society changes pretty dramatically, and I do not see evidence of that when I see the governor of the state of Arizona wagging her finger at our president and saying later that she was threatened by him. Mm-hmm. The reality is the implicit bias continues to exist, and we're giving our son the tools to deal with that. Whatever profession he decides, be it medicine or law or the arts, and he's going to have a critical awareness of those biases, and he's going to be able to compensate, just like his mom and his dad.
Compensate or challenge in a way that's constructive for everyone involved, because we understand that these types of assumptions or the way our society is structured or the conversations that we need to have to come around the entire community, because what we do know is that there is a societal and economic cost to the current status quo around race and race relations and assumptions, and we're all paying a cost for that, and that it's really to the benefit of us all to engage in change within our spheres of influence that we're able to, where we're able to interact. But we need the tools for that.
And the kind of conversation we're having is the conversation that parents all across this country, no matter what race or income level they are having with themselves and with their kids and with other parents. I'm curious, just sort of quickly, if you were talking with a bunch of parents like yourselves, educated, middle-class parents, not white, what advice would you give them now, looking back on your choices, about educating their kids?
Well, usually they want two or three things that they can do that will make a huge difference in their son's life. And we start by saying that if you really want to encounter implicit bias and the impact that race has on him, one of the things you can do is tell him that you love him, give him a hug, and tell him that he's destined to do well. So we give him a sense of pride, and that has a huge impact in them. They're being able to look at someone and says, no, I am not lazy. No, I am not someone who can't do math or can't do algebra. No, I have a bigger horizon than you're able to see.
I think another really important takeaway for us is really the need for parents to have their peer support in the same way that our boys need positive peer interactions. We need parent support groups or interactions with others within the school, without the school, where we can share information, but share our experiences, and in some cases even be mentored by those who've already been through the process to, you know, find the right direction and create a community that can support, you know, our community of kids. This was really key for us. You see it in the film in the sixth grade. You know, we call it the parent powwow that came together. And after that was dispersed, we kept together, you know, ad hoc conversations on the phone throughout our son's school career, just to share information and feel more validated, even in terms of advocating for our sons in school. I think the other really crucial thing I would say is we as parents need to engage with the educators from day one, because we need to fill in that narrative so that those teachers don't rely on their stereotypical assumptions that they don't even know they hold in order to define who our son is. So we need to step in and be present whichever way we can, email, telephone, coming to the classroom, engage with those teachers in a constructive way that allows them to see our children for who they are, but also get to know us. Mm-hmm. And that's how we break down those barriers.
I think one thing you should know is that educators are not pushing back on this.